some queer Puerto Ricans feel as if they're from another planet, strangers in a strange land, no matter where they go. But negotiating between cultures gives us fresh eyes to seek out the infinite possibilities.
On today's show, we're talking to the hilariously giddy Larry LaFontaine, professor of queer studies at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor. Don't let the title of professor fool you. Larry's full of laughter and insight.
His new book, Blue Fingernails, Uñas Pintadas de Azul, is a collection of 14 exotic short stories on sexy subjects like S&M, trannies, prostitution, science fiction, robots, fashion, and pornography.
Listen as Larry takes a look at living outside of the community you grew up in and what it means to be the other in today's modern world. Are we all like Spock on Star Trek?
Plus, our take on the new Star Trek movie. Is time travel the magical Hollywood eraser that can ignite the beloved science fiction franchise once again?
And Dolly Parton gets a PhD in fabulousness from the University of Tennessee in Knoxville.
I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Mark Villian.
And this is Feast of Fun. Get it while it's hot. Today's show is brought to you by generous support of fabulous listeners like you.
We really can't do the show without your support, so please visit our website, feastoffun.com, and make a donation. Buy a t-shirt.
Your financial support makes all the difference.
Thank you. Today's show is also brought to you in part by LifeLube.org, your sweet spot on the net.
LifeLube is your big tent guide to gay men's health, from sex and drugs to fairies and bears. It's your friendly concierge for all that's gay, sexy, and healthy.
LifeLube wants to know, how are you healthy? Go to LifeLube.org and tell them about it.
I'm here with Larry LaFontaine. He is hilarious, and his laughter is more infectious than the swine flu. Hi, Laddie.
Hi. That's dangerous.
You're kind of a dangerous writer. Larry has received several awards for his creative writing and scholarship, as well for his work with Latino, lesbian, gay, bisexual, and transgender students. You have tranny students.
I have transgender students, quite a few, in fact.
You've got a new book, Blue Fingernails, Uñas Pintadas de Azul, in Spanish, a collection of 14 short stories in English and Spanish of journeys through pain and pleasures of being a queer Puerto Rican living in a postmodern, crazy, rumble-tumble world. Your book moves between the topics of S&M, trannies, prostitution, and porn, and he's here in Chicago reading passages from his new book. Welcome to Feast of Fun, Laddie.
Thank you so much.
Welcome, Larry.
You brought me a present.
I brought
your book.
I brought you a Star Trek Pez dispenser.
Oh, we just saw the film last night.
And I know fabuloso.
You're such a Star Trek fan.
That one kind of looks like me. This Scotty version looks like me.
And my friend Danny and I thought you guys would enjoy it.
Thank you, Danny.
Gracias, Danny. Oh, my God. So Star Trek, the only problem I have with it is there's no Belana Torres. There's no Latinos in the new series.
How can that be?
Because in the Voyager series, there was a half Klingon, half human, and one quarter Hispanic Belana Torres.
What's the difference between a Latino and a Klingon anyway?
Let me finish what I was going to say, though. What was really fascinating about her character, and sort of is an overarching theme of your book, is that she was a woman caught between two worlds, being a Klingon and being human, not really fitting in as a human, not really fitting in as a Latina, as a Klingon. And in a lot of ways, the plot lines of this character in the series Star Trek Voyager sort of resonate and echo in the themes of your writing and what it means to be a queer Puerto Rican living in 2009.
That's kind of interesting and very profound. And to be honest, I had never thought of it that way. But I think you can say that it's true. I mean, when I wrote these short stories in the 1990s and the beginning of the 2000s, it was really about figuring out, well, not even figuring out, but sort of processing my experiences in New York and sort of tying them in with lots of cultural references and pop culture references and Hollywood references. So you're absolutely right that that's sort of how Star Wars gets into the book, as much as just going to bars or clubs in New York or in Cuba or in Brazil.
You write about androids. You write about guys who hallucinate. I mean, the title of the book, Blue Fingernails, is about a guy who hallucinates when he gets his fingernails painted blue and believes he's in a bar with Han Solo and Chewbacca. And then he believes he's transgendered eventually.
I know, because you know what happened was at first it was...
How high were you when you wrote that?
I wasn't high at all. I don't really do drugs, and which is... I don't know. I don't want to say that I'm boring or anything, but what was happening was that I was writing about myself, and then sort of you figure out it's just like a little boring just to only stick to the autobiographical. Mm-hmm. Not even boring. It's just not true to our experiences of being people who engage the world, watch movies, watch TV, read, talk to other people. And all of a sudden to realize that I could talk about my own experiences, but talk about them in relation to other things, or just go crazy, you know, just start writing and let ideas come out of my mind without filtering them, without thinking about them. And in fact, that's what most excites me about literature, the possibility of creating something that is not stuck to a realist representational mode. You know, you don't have to just talk about what happens for real. You can do whatever you want because it's literature.
You can fuck shit up all crazy. Fuck shakes things up. And so I just love your laughter, by the way.
I know. We're going to try and make you giggle all through the show.
It's tickle time, buddy.
I'm very ticklish.
You are?
Yes.
I'm going to go tickle Larry.
Stop, Jason.
So, I mean, it's sort of interesting. Do you feel, as being gay and being Puerto Rican like I do, that I identify with B'Elanna Torres, that she was never fully human, never fully Klingon, that we felt like we were outsiders in our own world, and we were never one part of one or the other?
Well, I feel that I'm negotiating between spaces. You're absolutely right. And
oh, how lesbian.
Why are you saying that? It's lesbian.
We're in Andersonville, after all.
We yes. are.
The home of lesbian Midwest.
I am a feminist identified pro-lesbian gay man.
You do teach women's studies, don't you?
I do.
Okay.
I do. In fact, I write about lots of lesbian Puerto Rican writers.
So you're negotiating spaces.
What does that mean to negotiate a space? You mean you're caught between worlds?
What it means, I mean, we're human beings and we bring all of our identities and baggage and experiences with us to wherever we are. Mm-hmm. And lots of people want to put you in a little box mm-hmm. and figure.
Sure.
They want a clear, simple mm-hmm. thing. They want to see you, and they see me. They see this white, like, fair-skinned guy, and they're like, this guy can't be Puerto Rican. They listen to me, and they get nervous because they can't figure out why I speak the way. Like, some people think I have an accent. Some people think that I speak English.
Some people think you have a speech impediment.
Especially when I get nervous.
You know, I always say, come up to me and they say, funny, you don't look Puerto Rican. I said, you don't look retarded, but you said something really stupid. Because Puerto Ricans come in all shapes and sizes.
They do.
You mm-hmm. know, and you and I
blonde.
Just happened. You're
Rubio-ish.
It's sort of brown, I think, now.
Brown, okay. Yeah.
But
I was just in Puerto Rico, and my mom is like, I love this color. What color is it? And I'm like, Mommy, this is my real color. She's like, oh, come on. You can tell me. I'm your mother.
She thinks you're dying
really?
Your hair.
She thinks you're dying your hair.
I was like, I haven't dyed my hair. Well, I used to dye it so much mm-hmm. back when I used to paint my fingernails mm-hmm. all the time. So, like, now she just assumes
that... Let me guess, you would paint your fingernails blue.
Because it's such a masculine color.
So, what?
You know, the funny thing, I used to do the same thing.
So you must be searching for some kind of queer identity, because a lot of what you focus on is queer studies, and especially specifically queer in the Caribbean. So Cuba and Puerto Rico and other places.
But
like
I don't feel I'm searching for anything. It's just the things that interest me. I mean, it interests me. It's
you're not negotiating that space.
Well, I mean, I think of myself sometimes as an advocate or an activist. Uh-huh. I am creating spaces, opening spaces. I'm part of a community of scholars and artists that are documenting or discussing this, wanting to tell people about it or create a niche, a space for us.
Do you sort of, my sensibility of being Puerto Rican is that to be gay and to be Puerto Rican means rejecting some of the machismo that is deeply embedded in my own culture. And bell hooks talks about that in her writing, is that she's a theorist who says to fight racism and it means to fight sexism, and to embrace being gay and to being of a different culture means you have to reject certain aspects of your culture that define what it means to be a man.
And that was much, much more evident for me when I first moved to the United States, but that was over 20 years ago. And now my experience is more just living outside of Puerto Rican communities where people are really clueless, and then you're just sort of constantly trying to educate them or to get them to transcend their stereotypes about what a Puerto Rican is supposed to be about.
What is a Puerto Rican in 2009?
Puerto Ricans are all sorts of things, and what most excites me is that there's lots of queer Puerto Ricans. And
And Puerto Rican by marriage.
And what's so amazing is that right now in Puerto Rico and in the U.S., there's lots of Puerto Rican writers and artists and cultural producers and dancers and performers.
And podcasters.
How could I forget?
Well, actually just one, but
fabulous Puerto Rican podcasters.
There's some on the island too, though.
Gay podcasters who are doing really great stuff. And for me, that's just such a big change. Like to think about 10 years ago, it wasn't easy to identify all these gay Puerto Rican artists doing interesting stuff.
Why has that change happened?
I'm not quite sure. I think it has to do with general social changes around the world, and Puerto Rico and Puerto Ricans are part of the world. And as things are changing in the U.S., they're changing in the Caribbean. Although there's still a lot of homophobia there, there's also lots of spaces that have been created.
What's interesting I'm observing is that more and more people are curious to hear the story of these, as you say in the word, the diaspora, the diaspora, the stranger in a strange land, the person that comes from one world and enters another. Because I think that in a lot of ways, we're all outsiders to some extent in our own homes.
Well, I think it's just also, I mean, people are realizing that Latinos are becoming a major presence in the United States. They have to deal with issues such as migration, language, education. And so people are just becoming more aware that the United States is not a black, white country, that it's a multicultural, diverse, multi-ethnic country. And that sort of generates that interest. And in Europe, you have the same thing. Europeans are dealing with huge amounts of migration, and they're realizing that they have to be able to account and to understand for that cultural difference if they're going to be able to live in a democratic society.
And so right now, everybody's talking about Little Ashes, the movie that gives us the meat of Federico Garcia Lorca and Salvador Dalí, their tender, tender love affair. Everybody's very familiar with Dalí's famous paintings, the melting clocks.
Mm-hmm. I was disappointed we didn't see any melting clocks in that film.
I know.
I thought we'd see at least one.
Well, there was a melting, you know,
I went
sperm,
later.
But that would be probably like a special technical effect to get that clock to melt.
But it was interesting CGI. That for me, you know, having a family that comes from Spain and being queer, it's like it was a really great way of reconnecting with my heritage. And so it would be like these two great men had this very intense, passionate love affair that's been debated and discussed endlessly. But this film is like popularizing, and now everybody knows about their story.
Yeah, because for many years, it was just gossip. Gossip that only people who were very knowledgeable about the film world or about Spanish literature knew. For example, that Luis Buñuel, a very famous director who was,
he was also in the film.
Yeah, and
the hot guy.
He was a friend of all of them when they were all college students in the 1920s in Madrid. They all lived in the Residencia de Estudiantes. And
thank you, Maria Hinojosa.
Which in English, the Residencia de Estudiantes is a student residence.
Uh-huh.
Okay.
And
so that's like the official school.
And the story goes that Luis Buñuel was very cruel, and he was friends with Dalí and with García Lorca, but he would make fun of them for being a little bit ting-a-ling. And but I mean, the tragic story, of course, is that Federico Garcia Lorca got murdered by the fascists in 1936. So that's the real tragedy of the story. But what's so wonderful or incredible is to recuperate the legacy of queer artists who were, you know, major artists in Europe in the 1930s.
So how accurate is the story of Federico Garcia Lorca and Salvador Dali?
Is there any basis in fact to it?
I think so, but we would have to pull out the Ouija board to confirm with the spirits
we'll have a
of
seance
the
right now. Well, I think they did some reference. Dali had referenced it in a few kinds of ways, but I think later
and that's
in
what
his
the
life,
film is based on. Is Salvador Dali opening up in toward the later end of his life?
I think he was bisexual. I think Garcia Lorca was pretty gay and very tortured about it. He believed gay men should be very masculine, like Walt Whitman. He criticized effeminate gay men very severely.
Really? In what way did he do that?
He has a very famous ode to Walt Whitman in which he sort of basically says that, you know, all you effeminate sissies are basically the problem, and we should all be inspired by Walt Whitman, who was so masculine and loved other men at the same time.
He was a hairy silver bear. What kind of...
Well, that's kind of weird, too. So,
like, he looked like the farmer, the guy that chases you off the lawn with a rake.
So do you think Whitman has had, like, an influence on gay culture in that respect?
Very much so, or at least... So remember, Whitman's writing in the 19th century. Garcia Lorca comes in the early 20th century.
Okay.
This debate will never go away.
About the sissies and the butches and...
This is something that's
feminine.
Timeless.
Probably.
We will suffer this debate for the rest of our days and in generations to come. So get over it, people.
Don't you think someday that we'll come to accept people just for, like, you know, whether they're sissies or butchies or drag queens or whatever. They're just like, whatever.
Well, I mean,
I think the younger people is definitely are more open to different types of people.
I would say the debate between sissy and butch is really a debate over athleticism and militarism and whether we embrace a sensual lifestyle or sensual sensibility or a militaristic sensibility. And that is fundamental to all societies and all cultures throughout time.
I don't know. I think you lost me. I don't understand what you mean.
Militaristic versus sensual. Sort of like Hellenistic sensibility versus classical Roman sensibilities. You know, the macho, the army versus the flamboyant feminine sides.
Well,
These psyches are fundamental to all societies, and they're an endless discussion that has transcended history and time.
I think it's cool that there's difference. I mean, I love difference. So that I think the issue is prejudice, like whether you're going to feel that you're superior to someone else, as opposed to like a desire to eliminate. So
Like, of course, like some guys are attracted to only effeminate men, but doesn't mean they're going to discriminate against, a butch guy.
And hello, you know, we make movies that glorify the Spartans in 300, for example, but we could easily also make a movie that glorifies the effeminate Hellenistic artist.
That's Project Runway, honey.
Well, that's not a movie, though.
Well, but it's a TV show.
So, and then, you know, last week we were talking to Juan Carlos, who made a movie, Jose Martí and I, about the possibility and the debate over this great Cuban literary and political hero about him being gay.
Yeah, that's much more hearsay and more gossip.
But he was close to Walt Whitman.
He was friends with Walt Whitman.
He translated his stuff.
Well, let's put it this way. I think maybe because...
And he was in Spain, too. And I think Spain sissifies a lot of people.
I think people would have much stronger reactions to a claim that Jose Martí was not your traditional... typical masculine guy, because he's considered a patriot, a father of the Cuban nation. Mm-hmm. Well, Federico Garcia Lorca is just a poet, you know. So poets can do whatever they want.
So it's easier to do that. Well, but he was a poet as well, wasn't he? Not?
Absolutely, absolutely. And I think it's great to bring up this topic for discussion.
Right. I had no idea who he was until I saw this film.
Well, I knew
and then
about
it was
him.
Funny though. We were walking in Miami and I saw a little statue. I'm like, that's Jose Martí, isn't it? And they're like,
he's
that is him.
A very famous guy. And if you fly to Havana, you fly into Jose Martí International Airport.
And it's painted pink.
Well, it's red. the Spanish terminal number 3 is red.
Now, here's an interesting thing that a lot of founding fathers of the United States were also literary political figures like Thomas Jefferson and certainly you know, Abraham Lincoln, although he didn't write anything, multidisciplinary people. And Alexander Hamilton and George Washington all have their sort of gay subtext. And you just pick up a $5 bill or a $20 bill, it's either lavender or pink.
Mixed with that green.
With a little green inside of it. What is it about the founding fathers of these Western nations that have a lot of gay in them?
I honestly don't know.
But it is sort of interesting, don't you think, that we're starting to see...
people get things done.
Is that what it is?
They work. They know how to work. They know how to organize. They're innovators. They say, listen, if I'm going to stick a penis in your ass, we're going to figure out how it's going to fit. And so if we're going to create a nation, we're going to figure out how to create this nation. Whereas straight guys are just like, they'll just stay with the status quo.
You guys are crazy.
Yes, we are, Larry. Are you just figuring this out?
I mean, I think there's a lot of there's method to that madness, yeah. Though, that it is sort of, there's a spirit of innovation to being gay because our sex is not as obvious physically as it is to heterosexual sex.
Although, I don't know. I think some people instinctually know exactly what to do.
Where to stick it in. There is a lot of negotiation, yes. Though, that happens when two men have sex.
Who's
going to
be on top? Who's going to be on the bottom?
And that negotiation carries with it some inherent need to be creative.
Well, skills. People, I a mean, there is something to be said for the idea that outsiders, mm-hmm. or people who have to see by necessity the world in a different way are more attuned or more sensitive or more sensible to issues, have sort of a profounder vision, and maybe that's what you're talking about.
So we're talking to Larry LaFontaine. Now, you just got tenure
at the University of Michigan.
Congratulations. Now you can give the bird to all your enemies.
Is that Ann Arbor? Can you travel around to different cities, or are you staying in Ann Arbor?
I teach at the University of Michigan, Ann Arbor. That's correct.
So any student can enroll in your class, and they can touch you, and they can...
You can't encourage the students to touch.
Not sexually. I mean, like, you know, put your hand on the shoulder.
Yes.
And he can't escape.
Because he's paid to be there during office hours. So, what are your office hours, Larry?
They change every semester.
But it's posted on your website,
I always tell my students, yes.
And they can come. Do you have a lot of students come and hang out and
have coffee? Well, it depends on the class.
Should they bring you coffee or candy? What do you like better?
I don't know. They should ask me, maybe.
During Christmas?
I'm asking you now.
Right now, we're asking you.
Oh, you mean like ground coffee, like whole bean coffee?
Well, no, like, should they bring you a cup of coffee and just hang out and have tea with you?
Oh, well, they can like, email me and see what I'm in the mood for
that day.
Prince Larry LaFontaine. Or Fontaine. So your book, Blue Fingernails, Uñas Pintadas de Azul, the title of the book has a story where the young man, Jerry, hooks up with his gal pal Sylvia, and she insists on painting his fingernails blue, and he starts hallucinating that he's in a bar with Han Solo and Chewbacca. I always thought Chewbacca was gay. I mean, sorry. Well, gay, because he was like, you know, I was reading the Star Wars Wikipedia, the Star Wars Wiki, that Wookiees bond for life with either each other or with another human.
A humanoid.
Or another humanoid or a species. And so in the Star Wars movie, Chewbacca was sort of like, had a very deep emotional connection to Han Solo. Mm-hmm. And if you think about it, The presence of Princess Leia not only brought an end to the war, but also an end to their relationship. Mm-hmm. And so in a lot of ways, Princess Leia was Chewbacca's cock blocker.
Yes.
So there's a gay subtext there.
Well, you guys know a lot more about Star Wars than I do.
So let's read us a little bit about this hallucination that this guy has because as a result of fingernail polish. Okay. And let me warn the listeners. It's pretty trippy, so, you know, turn on the mood music and the mood lighting here.
Yeah. So basically, I mean, the story just goes along and you really don't know what's happening, but it says, "And the result, my dear beloved madam, his fingernails had been a thorough success. The hands acquired a new marvelous expressive character as a result of the astrocosmetic intervention. He always carried the black fingernail polish with him, such an intergalactic constellation of space-age war films that it was, in order to be able to retouch them in case of an emergency. He always brought the bottle to work, every single day unfailingly. His boss, a videographer, laughed when she saw it, as he was always in the clouds because of his profession. And then, as if he were an Arab woman, a desert astronaut, or a manicure queen, perhaps, in a harem, convinced that her man would come one day, locked up on the banks of the Nile, or between the Tigris and the Euphrates, with a multitude of other women who all shared the same dream, that she was his favorite, and would be the first to step with a very nicely painted tiny toenails on the constellation of Orion. With his painted fingernails, which could be seen through the subtle veil that covered his face, making them more seductive. A large, strong man, enormous, like a giant, with a long, dark beard and deep stare, that was undoubtedly who would save her. She had painted her fingernails to be taken far away on a magical carpet, perhaps crossing asteroid fields and dwarf stars to a cave with 40 thieves while cleaning an old oil lamp, which he would find on 14th Street in New York in one of those stores where they sold large clocks with the face of the Virgin Mary and rugs with Jesus and Muhammad and the 12 apostles, a photo of the moons of Venus and tigers and women in bikinis, and if Muhammad does not come to the mountain, well then, you know. I'll stop there.
And then Chewbacca goes, where's Chewbacca going into the story?
That was pretty trippy.
I don't know.
Later on?
Later on. You know, you're going to have to read it to find out. But, you know, it's. I mean, I play with science fiction. They're not. I mean, people who are hardcore science fiction buffs and know the genre very well will. I mean, these stories don't fit in any traditional category. Mm-hmm. They kind of borrow a little bit from science fiction, but they borrow from fantasy. They borrow from queer Latin American literature.
Because you had like Alibaba and the 40 Thieves
in
there.
Exactly. So that's exactly it. That's sort of like what happens if you like take the 1001 Nights and you mix them with Star Wars and you mix them with gay Latino writing and you mix them with my life.
You get a scrambled, delicious mess.
Thank you.
So your next story is Love is Intergalactic. And you sort of, you have a lot of sort of science fiction themes in your writing.
I was a big like Star Trek buff when I was a teenager, but then I kind of moved away from that.
What made you move away from it?
I don't know. I guess just different interests. But it's still stuck back there. And so it's still stuck back there in the giant blender of my brain. So that, like, you know, when I get crazy inspired mm-hmm. and I sit down at the computer and start to write and
it
everything.
Well,
so those, exactly, those things start to pop up.
And those are our myths. Yeah. These are our myths of today. You know, Star Wars, Star Trek, those are like our Greek gods and heroes and mythology.
Well, but I would also argue that for you know, having walked in the same shoes or almost the same shoes as you have, is that what attracts you and me to a lot of these stories is the fact that a lot of people who are carried away into strange exotic lands and they become sort of like players and they interact with these aliens. And in a lot of ways, being Puerto Rican and gay means that you're a stranger in the United States and also a stranger in Puerto Rico. And when you're traveling back and forth between these two spaces, you're always kind of like, you feel like you've beamed aboard a strange planet, you know, whether that be Chicago or San Juan.
Well, there's actually a film scholar called Charles Ramirez Berg, and in his book Latino Images in Film, he makes the argument that the new alien films are really all about Latinos.
I completely agree.
So that
Chewbacca
movie Alien
is Hispanic.
Yeah.
And the alien monster from the movie Alien is Hispanic.
He says, you know, the ultimate stereotype of the Latino, it's gone so bad that it's now Latinos aren't even human. Now they're just monstrous.
So, like, what is a monstrous Latino? I don't understand how that is. Explain that to me, because I'm confused.
Well, so. I mean, I don't want to dwell on it too much, but sort of the notion that there's this cultural anxiety in the mm-hmm. United States that white men, heterosexual men, are, you know, anxious about the fact that their country is no longer the exact country that they could easily control.
Where that they imagined what it
was. They can understand what
exactly.
It means to be.
And now we live in a country that recognizes gay people, that where women have gained enormous rights, where people of color and immigrants are demanding to have their rights. So it's the United States society has been transformed. And how do you express that? Well, one way to express that is through a fantasy of monsters taking over your world.
Oh, I see. So the alien monster taking over your ship is really a metaphor for the Mexican immigrant coming over and taking...
The bus boy at the restaurant.
The alien monster is the bus boy in your restaurant cleaning up after you.
So obviously, so if you
it's put a little ridiculous, but I know what you're talking about.
If you put it up to the test of rationality, it makes absolutely no sense. But what we're talking about is about cultural angst and anxieties and how that gets represented in Hollywood.
And henceforth, when you see the alien monsters, it's never like the first one. I think the first couple alien movies, they were smart about sort of like it was a battle between different ideas of what it means to be a woman. So you have sort of Sigourney Weaver battling another alien monster. I think the one where it's like, it's her and Newt, the little orphan girl.
Yeah, that's number two.
That's, I think, the most interesting and most intelligent of all the Aliens movies. The worst
I don't know. One. Number one's good.
Well, too. Number one's good, too. Because the alien monsters,
you don't know what it is,
impregnate men.
Yes.
And they have to have their babies.
It was the era of feminism and the Equal Rights Amendment.
But see, now when you focus on Alien versus Predator, it's really back to war games. And I think like when science fiction does worst, it's when it plays into the whole us versus them kind of idea, and not when it's really into creating clever and interesting metaphors for what it means to be human and what it means to be alive in modern day. And so when, you know, I think this latest Star Trek movie, as wonderful as it is, it really shines when it's sort of like... examining,
can't be funny.
Well, when examining the relationship between Spock and Captain Kirk and Uhura and all the other characters and how they come together, when it fails, it's when it's the humans versus or the Federation versus the evil time traveling not Vulcans, but the other ones are
Romulans.
The Romulans. I think that's where it fails.
Really?
Yeah, because it's like, I'm not interested in that. I'm like, you know, I can just turn on the news and watch Barack Obama talk about, you know, Iraq or how we're failing or succeeding over there.
Well, you have to have an enemy. You have to have something you're fighting against. These people have to come together for a reason.
But I think that when the good Star Trek movies work best is when the enemy complicates things.
Mm-hmm.
When the enemy makes what they're searching after become difficult. For example, in First Contact, which was the second best money-making Star Trek film, it's about humanity coming to terms with a larger society, with a more enlightened society at large, and the evil Borgs, the robots, the technology, trying to stop us from becoming citizens of the cosmos. But the new Star Trek movie is just about, like, you know, Kirk versus this guy.
Well, it's a coming of age story, though. It's these people coming into their own and how they came together. So that's where that story kind of comes from.
I though think that the new Star Trek movie is phenomenal, and I think it's very promising. It's now the best money making Star Trek film of all time.
It is.
It is. Yes.
Opening weekend was that.
Opening
powerful?
Weekend is number one. So everybody, you know, thumbs up. Everybody loves it. They're going to make 3 million more
Two
movies.
More. I don't. I like it, but I have some problems with it. I don't know if I want to go into it now because I don't think a lot of people have seen it, so I don't want to spoil it for anybody.
Just quickly, what's your shortcomings?
Well, some of the things that I didn't like is there was a whole like time travel thing, and you know, you're manipulating the timeline, and horrible things happen, which I'm sure they'll probably just go back and fix in the future.
Oh, I see. That's so, the thing. Well, science fiction, you always get.
Although
the ability
I have to get hats off to Winona Ryder, looking like Little Edie from Grey Gardens.
Wow.
I practically played her like Little Edie. Oh, Spock, I love you, Spock.
I'm and your mother, Spock. Mm-hmm. I wear things around my head and look like a Vulcan, but I'm not really a Vulcan because I'm a human. I married your father; he was a Vulcan. You know that you're half Vulcan. That means you have human and Vulcan qualities.
And there's a romance that goes on that I'm not going to say between which two characters, which is kind of like, what? Don't take that slash fiction effect away
know.
From me.
So anyways, yeah, go see it, but you know it's mixed reviews, but I'm looking forward to
it. I liked
more.
It I'm probably gonna go see it again just to
you have another
it.
Story in the book, Rites of the Devotion of the Cult.
Yeah,
a drag queen named Demonio María Sin Fuegos, which means what?
Without fire.
Demon Mary Under Fires.
She's in a porn film directed by Gigi LaRue and somebody else, and she's unsure whether she's a demon, an angel, or a vampire. She's part of the Trinity Trinity.
Yeah, so for example, so this is a story that's not science fiction, but obviously has a little bit more fantasy. It started out just being a story about sex clubs in New York, but then I was like, that's boring. So why not make it much more interesting? And, you know, about this character who has this complexity. She's not quite sure if she's a vampire or an angel or a demon, or she's all three of those things at the same time. But it doesn't matter because basically she's kind of bored. She doesn't want to stay at home jerking off. So she's gotten hired to make a porn film with Cici LaRue and Christian Bjorn. And basically she doesn't know. She's just out there on Times Square, 42nd Street, New York, dark night, dangerous. She's walking around and just basically doing what her directors tell her to do. So this part says, Angel walks into the $2 movie theater and they are showing a film with Antonio Banderas and Brad Pitt. A song and dance number, something very confusing. You scream and scream and pull out a dildo out of a closet. But who hears you, Demonio Maria? There's no one here, and you try to put it in, but it's too big. The vampire wants a little more of your blood, but you are already dry. There's nowhere to suck from. The light goes out. You pray that the sun will come out soon, that the automatic coffee maker will go on, or that you will burp some garlic breath, remnants of that roast pork and fried mojo-covered yuca you had for dinner in Hell's Kitchen by 47th and Night. Next to a violin that looks like a mandolin. Do vampires pay to fly or only to dance polonaise? It's always the same, lost memories, sighs, laments. What happened to the Pakistani guy? That's the Pakistani guy she spilled some hot coffee on when she walked into the movie theater. And then at the end, there's a little romance going on.
So we find out whether she is a vampire, a demon, or an angel.
And then, you know, trannies, and I would say, you know, drag queens by guilt of association.
What?
All three of those qualities, that they are, in a sense, in real life, demons, angels, and vampires.
That's interesting.
And you, you know, what do you think? What's
they're
your
like
thought
Kali.
Of
Kali?
Well, I mean, I think Kali. I think that's me.
You are a trans. Are you coming out as a transgender person?
I don't know. I mean,
what do you look like in drag? What is your drag character? You going to try out for RuPaul's Drag Race?
Wow. Well, my blog is called Lola Von Miramar.
Lola Von Miramar. Did you grow up in Miramar in Puerto Rico?
Did.
You did.
Yeah.
Oh.
Lola Von Miramar. So that's your drag name.
Miramar.
Yeah. But it's kind of like a homage to Rosa von Braunheim, the German queer director, who I'm very fond of. And people call me lots of things like Lorena and
Lorena,
Lola.
Lola. Lola be a good name.
Yeah, I think
why is, why is being sort of in between worlds of gender make you a angel, a demon, or a vampire?
I don't know, but it's...
Because I think most people listening to this would agree. Everybody thumbs up? Yeah, everybody says, yes. This is the, you know...
Well, when you screw around, when you do the gender fucking, it makes people kind of uneasy sometimes or unwary, and you're like, what's going on here? It can be very confusing to the mind, so you don't know. It's hard to register it. It's hard for your mind to wrap around it. Is this good? Is this bad? Is this interesting to me? Is this mundane? I don't know.
Can I offer this idea? Is that people who are attracted to doing that kind of thing, like myself and other people who've been on the show, who you've observed, dear listener, is that they have this sort of like, they have altruistic qualities, but they also have very selfish qualities to them. And they also have this sort of like trickster in them as well.
Well, and I think it's also about this complex relationship to what people perceive as normal. So on the one hand, to compensate, because you feel that you're a monster, you feel that you're a demon, or you're demonized by society, so you want to do the exact opposite, which is be an angel. You know, you want to be all or in some days, some moments, some circumstances, you want to overcompensate by being very good, and at other moments you just want to overcompensate out of anger or rage, and you want to do the exact opposite. And then and then there's all these cultural images sort of to portray us, and then sometimes you're like, I'm going to reject that, but then other times I'm like, fuck it, I'm going to, you know, since people consider me to be like that anyways, I might as well go with that.
So to be an altruist in a lot of sense is to be gender ambiguous, or to be an outsider.
Huh?
because in a lot of ways, like, I see Captain Kirk sort of to be this Yeah, this sort of like feminine character, because like in the film, he gets beaten up, and unlike a masculine hero, he doesn't succeed by his by the sheer brute force. He succeeds by like a drag queen,
sheer will,
by moxie. You know, by moxie, by taking gutsy, rebellious actions that may or may not succeed, and sometimes they don't succeed, but it's the risk taking, it's the being the outsider, it's being the rebel that makes them ultimately triumph.
Profound words.
Is it, I mean, you know, is it being to be an outsider and it, carry with it inherent qualities of being gender ambiguous? It means to be a rebel against what it means to be a man. Inevitable.
Well, I don't think all outsiders are gender ambiguous, are they? You know, like Elvis was like the roustabout.
People
you know?
Argue all the time that Elvis was had effeminate qualities to him.
Certainly with the hips.
It
right?
comes
the
with
hip
the
shaking or being a sexual.
Well, he had this
recognizing
very flamboyant
Marlon Brando.
They say he got a cock all over his face.
Because in our society, men are supposed to be like attractive by doing nothing. So whenever a man does anything or is acknowledges that attractiveness, there's already a question mark put next to him.
And then in your book, and you're going to leave us with this, is you have a wonderful story that's the shit, literally titled La Mierda
shit.
Or The Shit.
Shit, just shit. Shit.
Just shit. So la mierda, because in English you don't have to put the article.
I guess
shit.
Not.
Right? So yeah. Shit just stands alone.
Shit is la mierda.
La mierda.
If you say it's the shit, that means like it's like the best shit there is. Like, yeah. It's the shit, man.
And in a lot of ways, you know, I think like talking about these topics with you, Larry, it is the shit because it really like you have a wonderful, you bring a wonderful color to a lot of these things, a wonderful insight to it. So let's hear a little bit of La Mierda, the shit, or shit.
So I'm going to just read a tiny bit in Spanish because I don't know if we mentioned this, but I wrote all of these stories in Spanish. I consider myself a Spanish language writer, and then I translated them, and I was fortunate enough to be able to publish it bilingual. So
Why don't we do it in little ashes, and you'll read it in Spanish, and I'll read it in English at the same time.
Because this book is like on one page it's the Spanish, the other page it's the English.
Exactly.
Yeah. So and you translated it yourself.
I did.
Really?
So you, but you
did
know,
you translate it well?
I don't know. You're going to have to. You can be the judge.
Let's try that. Okay, ready, let's say go.
He was afraid to begin the story by talking about shit, but
I don't think this is working.
It's gonna be a mess.
Just do it in English.
Okay, so you know what? If you want to hear me read in Spanish, you can come to Nowhere Bar at the end of May, or you can come to Women and Children First at the end of June.
You're going
to
be there June 25th, right?
Uh-huh.
What day of the week is that?
That's a Thursday night.
Oh, you're going to be in town for Gay Pride Weekend.
Yes, sir.
All right.
Woo! Yeah, in Chicago.
And you know, because Larry is reading at Women and Children First, that means you're a little, you know, tingly.
So I'm going to just read a
little.
Why
don't you read like just a little bit of it? Give us like a first couple sentences and then start again in English so people get a sense of hearing the words.
Sí, señor.
Because, you know, a lot of people are not going to understand what you're saying. But
that's okay.
I think they would appreciate just the sound.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Le daba miedo comenzar el cuento hablando de mierda. Aunque esa emoción no le duraría mucho tiempo. ¿Y por qué no? Si Hans, a quien siempre le habían dicho Juan, llegó a su casa aquella noche lo antes posible, pero ya era tarde. Se había empezado a cagar el calzoncillo y como un torrente de represa rota, su mierda fulminaba hacia afuera en eyaculación precoz. He was afraid to begin the story by talking about shit, but his fear proved to be ill-founded. And why not? For Hans, whom everyone knew as Juan, got home as fast as he could, but it was already too late. He had started to shit in his pants like a broken, irrepressible dam, and his feces sprayed forward like a dark, premature ejaculation. I told he was a little dirty. It was bitterly cold that terrible night in which all of our worst possible nightmares began. My fear of censorship, the moment in which disgust will consume us all, both you and me, before the worms begin to feast on that rotting flesh that hangs off our bones, those half-disintegrated belongings that we excrete day after day without thinking twice. It is the secret longing that causes fear, I think, but I don't want to jump the gun. So I'll stop it there.
So this is the whole story about poop.
Yeah, well, it's about a guy who has some accidents, and then he realizes that...
They aren't accidents after all.
Well, it's a sort of exploration about...
So he's a scat queen.
Well, you know what? You're going to have to read the story to find out.
You know, this reminds me a lot. It's Karen Finley's story about the guy who was who sort of got supernatural qualities or powers by drinking his own urine.
Really? Mm.
It's a really good risk. I forgot the name of it. It's part of an anthology, but you can find it by...
I read one interesting...
You know what I'm talking about, though, right? The book?
Well, yes. And for me, it's a lot about a certain tradition in gay men's literature, like authors like the French Jean Genet or the American David Wojnarowicz, who really are interested in exploring the margins of homosexuality and radical sex practices, living on the margin, doing things that people really consider to be outsider.
Everybody's asking how much of this is a reflection of your own sexuality. I mean, they're all thinking it.
Menos, mucho, bastante.
Let's learn in Spanish. I will teach you Spanish con fiesta fun, okay? Here, menos is less. Más is more.
I'm going to plead the fifth.
Or bastante is a whole lot.
You know, the wonderful thing about literature and fiction is that some of these things have to do with me and some of these things are made up.
Just things you thought of one day.
Yeah,
Laddie, 100 years from now, the people will be making movies debating who you are.
I heard Larry LaFontaine really was straight.
Is the biggest misconception people have about you as a writer and as a gay man?
Wow. That's such a big question.
Yeah, because they'll have it 100 years from now. So now's the time to settle the record, because this shit will be around, you know? They'll be like, well, you know, he was on Feast of Fun in this episode, and he clarified that question pretty well, or he chose not to. Yeah. What is the biggest misconception people have? What is the biggest question you get asked about you as a person?
That's such a... You know, I'm such a... I mean, I practically, my life is an open book, and I also have a hard time like not showing the truth on my face. Like if listeners were like looking at me, like they would probably like be able to figure out answers to all sorts of these questions that you're asking me. So
you're a cuddler. You like to cuddle. That's basically it. You like to swim. You like to cuddle. You like to make out with trannies.
Sure.
And that's pretty much
Let me ask you this. Our show today is sponsored in part by lifelube.org, which is your sweet spot on the net. It's a gay, sexy, healthy blog, and they're asking people how they are healthy. So, Larry, let me ask you, how do you stay healthy?
I try to stay healthy by only trying to practice safe sex, by doing exercise and eating well.
Okay. And so you only eat fried yuca. Fried tostones.
And I only put a little bit of olive oil with garlic on it as opposed to putting tons of it.
And
tickle Larry again.
Yeah, go. Jason's going to tickle Larry.
Why?
Okay, I want to do... can I impersonate you just for a second?
Okay, I'll pretend I'm not here. Stop.
This
is very close and personal.
I know, right?
You don't know if it's me doing you or it's just you doing you.
This is the most unusual author interview I've had so far.
What you remind me so much is Uncle Albert in the Mary Poppins movie. Because he loved to laugh. And he laughed so hard, this character, that he floated all the way up to the ceiling.
Because you like to laugh.
I do like to laugh.
And in a lot of ways, whenever I'm with you, I feel like I'm floating up to the ceiling.
They say laughing is good for you.
I think it is.
That is the healthiest thing of all.
Oh, so that's a good answer to the Life Loop question. Yeah, Life Loop, you know. And that's funny because oftentimes we think of sex as being so serious, but I think sex is cool when you're laughing as well.
During it?
When it's with me, you're always laughing.
Oh, the jokes.
Okay, so we're going to leave you here with a little bit of music. So we got our, they got their, go to lifeloop.org
and read more.
And in 2 weeks, we're going to be doing a live public forum, Bridging the Gap Between Generations. Mm. Generation me, generation you, generation why me. How do you bridge the gap between old and young?
Right, without being perverted.
That's a good question.
Or maybe
question.
You can be perverted. Yeah. You know, how do you form relationships and friendships with people that are old and young, Vlad? Mm-hmm. What do you do?
I think you listen. Yeah. You go out there and you listen and you're friendly.
Because you must have a lot of relationships with younger people because you're a teacher. So you're dealing with a lot of these 18, 19, 20-year-old kids.
Well, I mean, I think, and to be a storyteller, that's what it's about. It's about having, like, the willingness to listen to people's mm-hmm. stories and figure out who they are and, you know, sort of realize that everyone has a little bit to say.
Mm-hmm.
That's wonderful. Larry, thank you so much for coming on our show.
You're welcome. Larry. Thank you
Let's
for having me.
Let's go get some Puerto Rican food. Is there any question for me?
So the book is Uñas Pintadas de Azul, Blue Fingernails. It's available from Larry or Lawrence LaFontaine-Stokes. That's... Who the hell is Stokes? Your mama?
Yeah.
Tu mami. And you can get it through our website, feastoffun.com. It's a fun book, especially if you're learning how to speak Spanish. It's, you know, you have the Spanish and the English side by side, so you can appreciate the original words in the language, and they're translated by Larry LaFontaine, one of Feast of Fools favorites. We're gonna leave you here with some music from Viento de Agua.
That's so cool.
I know, we give you a
shout out to Puerto Rico.
Puerto Rico, what kind of music is this exactly?
It's plena. It's like new plena.
New plena?
Yeah, it's a traditional musical form, but like being performed by young people with like new inflections.
The plena's from the mountains or something.
No, coast, black coast, people.
The south?
Sí, del sur, del norte, del este y del oeste. Plena
they
Puerto Rico.
They love to play it at weddings.
Y whenever you want to have a good time.
It's a plena. This is Viento de Agua, available through our website, feastoffun.com. Mark, what does wepa mean?
That means woo.
Bye.
Wepa means wepa. I'm Fausto Fernos.
I'm Arturian.
And I'm Larry LaFontaine.
Thank you, Larry.
Yay.